Hey, this is Christian Horn of Part-Time Fanboy, and I am here with the second week of Part-Time Fanboy's Top 10 Comic Book Moments That Blew Our Minds. Hope you enjoyed last week's picks. Once again, this is the second in a series of three podcasts that we recorded just talking about our favorite moments in comic book history. So please enjoy this second part of Part-Time Fanboy's Top 10 Comic Book Moments That Blew Our Minds. And hopefully you'll tune again next week to check out the third part of this series. Thanks for listening. Number seven, Corey.
Good picks. Good picks.
Good picks all around. I'm excited.
My number seven, speaking of the first comic that made you cry.
Yes.
Strangers in Paradise.
Oh, I've never read that.
The second trade, I Dream of You. I never read this. Well, I did read this in singles, but I didn't read these issues in single issues. I got into it probably early college. Uh-huh. And so, you know, by now I was starting to get burned out on Marvel and just superhero comics in general. Felt like they weren't going anywhere. Yeah. And so New Warriors had been canceled, so any reason to live had long since passed. And so I started looking elsewhere, and a friend at college suggested Strangers in Paradise. And so I read it. And so the second trade, I Dream of You, the first trade is more played as kind of a sort of romantic comedy, not in sort of the Hollywood way, but it's, you know, there's romantic themes explored, and it's often funny. Uh-huh. And it centers around a romantic triangle of Francine and her friend nicknamed Cachou. Uh-huh. and then two women. So Cachou kind of has a crush on Francine, and then along comes David, who has a crush on Cachou. And uh-huh. So they're sort of all, you know, chasing each other around in a circle. The first one, you know, is good, but it really, I think the series really takes off and finds itself in that second trade in I Dream of You, where suddenly there's sort of this crime underworld element that's introduced. There's, you know, it can get very serious, but also can return back to its, like, that playful, silly side as well. So it's really good at kind of playing those tones back and forth, but it really explores the consequences of violence. And there's towards the end, one of the main characters appears to be shot and killed, and the way that is depicted and handled, he slows it down in a series of panels. So it's like she's, you know, you see her get shot, and as she's falling, it's like a whole page of her slowly falling. And it's just such a, like, heartbreaking moment, because it's really builds up to this tense moment where Francine is kidnapped by this kind of mobster figure who had control over Cachou. Like, Cachou used to be essentially a bodyguard or an operative for this, like, sort of all-female mob. Huh. And she was trying to be pulled back, you know, they were trying to pull her back in and control her. And so they kidnap Francine, and it's really tense. Like, he really works up well this tension, this, like, suspenseful moment. And there's, you know, there's this gunplay, and she gets shot, or one of them gets shot, and just that page is just, like, heartbreaking, how she falls to the ground. And, you know, you think that that's it, it's over. Uh-huh. And that at the end was the end of the issue. So I'm sure, like, reading it monthly, or I think it came out every other month maybe, or every 6 weeks or so, it probably was, like, agonizing, like, oh my, they just killed one of the main characters, you know?
Nice.
And so And then the next issue, you know, is this very dreamlike sequence, and then, you know, and she slowly comes out, and you know, she's in the hospital, and you know, she makes it. Uh-huh. But and you know, at the same time, he's playing, the artist Terry Moore is the writer and the artist, the cartoonist, and he's playing with different styles. Like, it was a little bit more silly art initially, but then as the themes and the tones shift, his art style shifts, and it really kind of matures, and he plays with music. Like, there's sheets of music that he wrote, like an original song.
Oh, wow.
That is worked into the art and into the story. There are pages of prose that are part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so he shifts from comics to, you know, to like full on, you know, text with accompanying illustration. And so he's really kind of experimenting with the story, and it's a really great series. It as it goes, you know, past this trade, you know, and in these subsequent years, it meanders a little bit, and then he kind of grabs back hold of it, and it really finishes nicely. But so it's a really beautiful series. It's probably this. It's. I would say definitely the series that got my wife to reading comics.
Huh.
That's what I was able to convert her with. And so yeah, highly recommend this one.
Oh,
and
that's interesting. I've never read Strangers in Paradise, and I hear it's great.
I remember reading it late at night. It was probably like 3 a.m. I was at home. I think it was the summer between college, and I was just I'm just gonna start it.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna read one more chapter.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like 3 a.m. and you know, and I just finished it, and I was like crying, and I just went to sleep, and it was it's amazing. You know, it was the first time I'd ever been so moved by a comic.
Yeah. It's got a really good reputation. I'm gonna have to pick it up someday. I really do want to check it out. Especially, I mean, it's got a good reputation too for being very respectful of, you know, female characters and having three-dimensional female characters, which unfortunately in superhero comics you don't get a lot of, or if at all. So,
right.
You know, so Don, what's your number 7?
Number 7 for me is we got to go to to the 1990s with the introduction of Kurt Busiek's Astro City.
Oh,
cool.
Good choice. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's I guess another one of the things where we were thinking of when we were thinking about, I guess, putting this particular list together of stuff that the impactful things that were people, I guess, change the way you think about comics or raise the standard a little bit. And
sure.
And Astro City is definitely one of those things for me that changes the way I thought about comics and superheroes in particular, where it takes the superhero tropes and kind of turns things on its head, you know, of why maybe Superman and Wonder Woman can't necessarily date because people are, you know, would be, you know, well, and taking it in the Astro City character with Samaritan, where he's hanging out for every moment that Samaritan is not out saving the world, people are dying. So
yeah.
So he's like, well, I guess I didn't think about it that way, and that's the entire idea of Astro City, of taking these moments and these heroes of what it would really be like if a person tried to dress like a superpowered human and was mistaken by, you know, the bad guys as a superhero, and what the ramifications are of making that choice.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things, taking them all and turning them on their heads and making you think about those types of universes and what really happens or what really could happen. And so, yeah, it's every issue makes you think. Every issue's got fantastic art. Kurt Busiek, Brent Anderson, and of course the Alex Ross covers. The first collected edition, Life in the Big City, one of my favorites. The Confession, the second trade collection, is also really a very, very strong thing. But a great start for pretty much anybody if they want to catch up. Life in the Big City is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that was a great series. I mean, and he's doing it again now, isn't he?
Yeah, it's kind of relaunched every month. The first collected edition of the new volume of stories is due out in a couple months. So, yeah.
Oh man, yeah, I'm gonna have to get back into Astro City because I remember the publishing schedule kind of went a little like sporadic for a while, and you didn't know if new issues were coming out or when they were coming out. And then he kind of put it on the shelf for a while, and I remember loving Astro City. Because they kind of took the formula that worked really well in Marvel's, as sort of like you're in this city where there's all these superheroes and you're looking at it from the outside, or they pick somebody that, you know, they they kind of told it from outside the superhero's perspective, right?
Well, yeah. Every story is different. Some of them are from the perspective of the hero. Some of them are man on the street. Some of them are, the bad guy. So he just takes a different perspective all the time. But it is, it's looking at the superhero universe and why they do what they do at completely different angles. And I don't know that it was necessarily, I don't know if his idea for Astro City inspired Marvel's or the other way around. But
he worked on Marvel's first, So
true. Yeah. I mean, as far as his ideas and what he's done, but as far as I guess the schedule, it was pretty frustrating for anybody that liked the comic even a little bit. But health problems, he's fought through a number of health problems, and then he spent a couple of years getting a bunch of issues in the box. That's what we're reading now, so that he publish it monthly again. So
yeah, I remember really enjoying the Confessor storyline, like the sort of Batman, like church guy sort of with the sidekick. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking that was very interesting take on like sort of the vigilante character. Like, I remember that was Astro City. I mean, that's definitely one of the benchmarks, of like comic history. Like you said, it turned things on its ear and it made people go like, oh, you can look at it in a different way. That's a really good pick, Don. I hadn't even thought about Astro City. That's fantastic. Yeah, good deal.
Cool deal.
What about you, Paul? Number seven?
Number seven for me is going to be the series that got me back into superhero books. I did Vertigo for a long time, alternative press stuff, and didn't really pay attention to much of the superhero stuff. But in the mid '90s, Starman came out, and James Robinson was the creator behind. He's the writer behind it. Tony Harris and Peter Snageberger were the artists.
I could really use a Snageberger right about now.
Yeah, they're delicious. Yeah, Starman was really cool in the sense of it was the first series that I remember coming across that acknowledged the years of history that had gone into like comic book superheroes for the characters. Not necessarily for the readers, but in terms of the characters, I mean, this is a guy whose father was the original Starman, and and who was friends with the Sandman, who was part of the JSA and everything. And so basically it's this sort of character who's got a legacy to uphold, and it's the actual DC legacy. They make references to things that happened years before, and that's just part of that's part of what his dad grew up what his dad went through. And the relationship between Jack and his dad is probably like one of the best father-son characterizations I think I've ever seen in a book, because there's times where they don't get along, there's times where they fight, there's times where they keep secrets from each other, but ultimately they just love each other, care about each other, and the family is sort of the key central theme of the book. And another thing too is that that Jack Knight, who's the Starman in the book, really isn't a fighter. He's more of a when the book starts, he's a essentially a collectibles dealer. He deals in vintage clothing and books and albums and things like that. He's not a fighter, and a matter of fact, a lot of the conflicts that he faces in the book, he manages to solve them without any kind of violence. And a lot of the things in peacefully. He's very much more of a thoughtful character, and because I remember, one of the issues that really summed it up great for me is that he walks into his dad's workshop, and he's wearing a t-shirt. The t-shirt is like sort of the stylized Ragdoll face, and apparently Ragdoll was like a super villain that his dad had faced off against, and his dad, you know, is just kind of like, well, you know, that's, I can't believe you're doing that, and he's like, well, you know what, it's ironic, you know, it's like, you know, it's like a Che Guevara shirt or something, like, you know, he's just kind of playing it off, and his dad then proceeds to tell the story about how this villain, you know, murdered a bunch of people and nearly killed his mother and like all of these other things. And, you know, and after going through that, you know, it really like hits home. It's like, wow, you know, this was, you know, it's not just an ironic thing anymore. And at the end of the story, he's like, you know, I'm going to burn this shirt. This, you know, I didn't understand before. And it's really what the whole series seems to be about, is about like reaching more of an understanding of what it's like to be a hero rather than just going out and, you know, doing stuff.
I'm going to have to read that series, because I remember that's another one where I picked up the first trade and I liked it, but it didn't blow me away. Like, I was like, okay, I don't understand. But I guess that's the thing that I have to learn, is that, you know, sometimes series in the beginning, they take a little while to pick up steam, you know?
Yep.
Interesting. That's cool. That's great. I'm going to have to... Anyone else have thoughts on Starman? Did you guys read it, Corey or Don? Or...
No, I... Yeah, that's another one where I think I'm in the same boat. I have the same trade, and the first trade.
Yeah.
And yeah, I kind of have that same problem, Christian, where I'm a little impatient. I'm like,
yeah.
Well, if it can't get me in six issues, then tough luck.
Yeah, you're screwed. Sorry, buddy.
But you know, I was actually talking to mention Miguel again, but we went to Heidi Ho and we were just looking at, you know, we were just walking around looking at stuff, and we saw Popeye, and I was reminded those Popeye collections that he didn't, he appeared in the Thimble Theater comic strip, but he didn't show up for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was just about Olive Oil and her brother and her fiance.
Oh, wow.
And then 10 years in, a decade, they were like, oh, we have to get to this island. I'll just hire this deckhand, this sailor on the decks who happened to be Popeye. And he just was a breakout character, and he became the star and took over the whole strip, and then just shuffled around, that, you know. And so it's like, you got to give stuff time sometimes.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm definitely, because Paul always mentions that series, so I'm going to have to pick up, like, I know they have hardcovers now and collections, and so I'm going to have to pick those up, because I definitely trust Paul's taste, so... let me see. My number 7 is, I don't know if it's as highbrow, but Starman or Astro City, but, my number 7 moment was Uncanny X-Men number 183, Colossus breaks up with Kitty.
And
I remember reading the first panel, I think the first couple of pages, where, like, I think Kitty's like crying because Colossus went to the like Secret Wars world and he met that tramp, I can't remember what her name was, Johnny or something, and fell in love with this alien woman. But before this issue, I did not realize that like people could break up like in comics. Like, I didn't realize, you know, it was always like Lois Lane and Clark Kent, and Lois Lane treated Kent like shit, and that was it. Like, you were just kind of stuck with it. There wasn't any real like relationships. And I remember just like those first couple of pages, like where Kitty's talking about like that Peter didn't want to be with her, Colossus. And she's like heartbroken. And I think it was like the very first time I read a comic book where I was like, I feel so bad for you. Like, where I was just like, you know, and I was like everyone else in the comic, because basically it culminates with like a lot of the male X-Men taking Colossus out to a bar, and then they get into a huge fight with the Juggernaut, of course, because they run into the Juggernaut at this bar, you know, without knowing it. But,
don't
you know,
we always.
Yeah, isn't that the way it always goes? But I just remember just sitting there being like, just reading that comic and just being like, wow, this is like, this is a comic book character that for the first time I feel like really, like something normal has happened to them, like that would happen to like you or me, and just being like, oh, like I feel so bad for you, you know? So that was one of the moments of emotion that just really came through for me. And and it was in an X-Men book, and at that time I was a big X-Men fan, so you know, Colossus and Kitty kind of breaking up
I remember that. Didn't Wolverine like not help? He didn't step in and help.
Yeah.
Colossus in the fight, so just so that he could get his ass kicked,
just so he could get his
because he deserved to get it. Yeah.
And I remember Nightcrawler kind of coming across Juggernaut, Kane Marco at the bar, and going back to the table and being like, "I think we should go." And Wolverine's like, "No, we're not gonna go. We're gonna sit right here and kind of see what happens." And that was Chris Claremont and John Romita Jr., I think, did that issue. And that that issue, just the whole thing was just blew my mind, and I loved it. It's one of my most memorable comic moments as a kid, like reading it and just being like, "Oh man, this is great stuff." So, yes, I was a big X-Men fan back there. It was before X-Factor and all those crossovers and Bob Liefeld and whatever his name is, you know, all that stuff. So
that's cool though. Like I love that sort of discovery of, you know, empathy and of, you know, oh, like real relationships, you know, like,
yeah.
I love that discovery of, oh, people can break up, you know, that's really cool.
Yeah. It was just something that didn't happen in comics, like Lois Lane or anybody.
Cyclops and Jean Grey were always except she died, but that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was always sort of like, oh, she likes me, she doesn't like me, blah, 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 blah. Right. But this was like, he does not want to be with me, I love him, he's breaking up, and this is going to have repercussions on the team. Like, other people are going to be hurt by this. Who do I remain friends with? And being a teenager, you would come across that. Like, Billy broke up with Susie, and who do I be friends with? You know what
I
mean?
Right.
So it was very, it just spoke to me at the time. And I still think, having read it since then, I still think it's a very, I mean, John Romita Jr., I mean, during the 80s, I think he was just on fire. He knew how to portray emotion and storytelling, and he was great. So I love that issue of the X-Men. Anyway, Corey Blake, number six.
We're
getting there. We're getting there, people.
We're almost sort of halfway there.
Almost sort of halfway.
So this is probably an unconventional pick because it is nonfiction. So after, you know, Strangers of Paradise kind of made me realize, like, wow, comics can do a lot. And so you know, I started to sort of explore more outside of the mainstream comics, and just the idea of comics started to really fascinate me, and the you know, what were they, how did they work? And so I got Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. And this really blew my mind because the way he breaks down and explains how comics work and how they are really a language unto themselves and a form unto themselves really changed how I perceived comics.
Yep.
And the way he talks about the symbols that are used and how our brain translates that, and really, really, you know, just blew my mind. The way he talks about different art styles and the representation of them and how universal it can be, the more simplistic the art can be. And the way time is portrayed and how panels respond to each other, how they are laid out on a page and how our brain translates that, how our brain connects the gap between the panels and fills in the hole, and how our brain is actually working hard and not just passively taking in information like TV or movies. There's just so much that it really expanded how I appreciate comics and how I read them.
Yeah.
So it completely blew my mind.
Yeah, that really is a big landmark in not just comics reading history, but just comics history in general. I mean, Will Eisner had done some like sequential art books before, but I think Scott McCloud just like broke it down and was like, you know, just really, I mean, required reading for anyone who ever wants to create their own comic or just really doesn't even know how to read comics, maybe, because I know a lot of people I run into is like, how do I read this? I don't understand. Like, what bubble do I read first? And like, I just think that Scott McCloud probably, I mean, he's almost like the first saint of comic books, you know, which, maybe not the first. You got Stan Lee and, you know, Jerry Siegel and Joe you know what I'm saying? But he probably, in modern times, is probably the singular most person that did the greatest thing for comics. You know, yeah. I think that you can't talk about how impactful that thing was, how much of an impact that book had on comic creators and stuff. So
and I love that he had so much faith in the form of comics to communicate, that he used comics to do this. This wasn't like a textbook. This is like, it's comics explaining comics. Like, I love that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it really is genius, and it definitely, for anybody that ever read it, it was just like an eye opener. It was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even really think about this. So
yeah,
that's a really good choice, Corey. That's an awesome choice. What's your number six, Don?
Well, first off, I think we should change the order. I don't want to go after Corey anymore. Brilliant, amazing choice. McLeod is, and if you ever get a chance to meet or run into him in a convention, he's an incredibly nice guy, fantastic human being, and loves comics almost as much as us right here. But, yeah, no, the thing about the panels, that's what I try to explain to people all the time. What makes comics better than other art forms? Because I believe that comics are a superior art form because it's combining so many of these elements. It's because your brain completes that action. When he's talking about that sample of the panel is a guy with an axe, then it's, you know, you have your space in between the panels, and then somebody is screaming. The person with the axe didn't kill the person or hurt the person. You did. Your brain did that damage.
Mm. Yeah.
So for your brain to do all that activity just in between the space of those panels is amazing. When Superman takes off in one panel, in one continent, and he lands in Metropolis, your brain completed that flight and imagined all the things they might have seen on that supersonic flight from, you know, whatever, you know, city to that city. So your brain, yeah. McLeod's, yeah, he's a genius. It's a fantastic choice.
Absolutely.
I quit, yeah.
No, don't give up, Don. In the Marvel spirit, you must continue no matter what.
All right. My number six, Uncanny X-Men, number 133, Chris Claremont, John Byrne, May 1980. Just one piece of the best superhero run in the history of comics. I think that what I talked about before for my number nine, back with in 78 when Shooter is examining those bigger stories, this was basically just a great serial fiction taking full advantage of serial fiction and constantly building the story. You could probably make an argument that from the very beginning of Claremont's run to the end was one continuous story, that he just constantly added this chapter and substituted that, and of course Byrne being one of my favorite artists of that era. This was the one before Grim and Gritty, before Deconstruction. There was X-Men 133, where Wolverine in the sewers against the Hellfire.
Oh, yeah.
Down. And, as a young reader at that particular time going, oh my gosh, they can turn to the level. What is happening here? He's fighting against the odds. He's going against a situation that he can't possibly win, and he makes it, you know, almost look easy. So you figure out just what Wolverine's capable of doing, and that darker side. It was a very dark comic, and yet he's doing for the greater good. So you start to examine what a superhero is supposed to be. Is that okay? Because so many comics, again, and this is 1980, not a lot of death and destruction to that point.
Yeah.
And with the big two companies as far as superhero comics. So it turned comics on its head. It was already a series that I loved every single month. Couldn't wait to read the next one. And really, so much of, you know, what's happened, I guess, in the last 10 years kind of still apes, I think, some of the classic elements of Claremont's brilliant run. So, I love that. I mean, Wolverine, he's in every comic everywhere, whether it's Marvel, DC, or Image, Wolverine is on the cover somehow.
Yeah.
But
but it does kind of, it kind of goes back to that moment, though.
Yeah, it does. Very much. I mean, Don is very correct. You know, it's... That was the moment that sort of like set Wolverine like on his path to being like the best he is at what he does. You know what I mean? Right. Like that he was gonna sort of kick ass and take names. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or not take any names. You know?
Yeah. Not take any names.
That can really slow things down.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No. I remember, again, I read, this was part of that that Dark Phoenix trade that I read when I was a kid. So I didn't have to wait between months. But it was my kind of like first exposure to the X-Men and to John Byrne and Chris Claremont, and just being like, this guy's gonna kick some ass. And sort of like Wolverine almost being like a problematic character, because he did have those knives in his fist, but you couldn't necessarily show him like gutting people, yeah, like too graphically, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I just remember just being like, what are they going to do with this guy? Like being very conflicted about Wolverine, because superheroes didn't stab people, you know? and so it's just amazing like how that those beginning baby steps like really kind of fully fleshed out that character and made him almost what he is today. I mean, that is a really great sort of almost Die Hard issue, you know, where it's like Wolverine alone against everyone else, right?
Yes, yep. And I wore it out, that particular issue. I had to buy another one and then replace that one, lending it out to friends who kept reading it. And so, yeah, in just a span of 30 days, we wore it out a couple of times, because everybody was so, you know, did this really happen? Is this really cool? And you couldn't wait to see what happened next, which is the whole idea, I think, of serial fiction and this particular format. And if every floppy was of that quality, I mean, would we be talking about trades as much if they kept up that kind of quality?
Yeah, oh no, I agree with you 100%. I mean, it was definitely a different time where it was serialized storytelling. And you actually felt like, even though, I don't know if the cliffhanger was before this issue or was this issue, where it's like, now it's my turn or whatever, like he says he's coming out of the sewer and he's all like, you know, got the claws out and he's like, that's it, you know. But I just remember thinking, like, you used to feel like you would get a full story in an issue of a comic, even if there was a cliffhanger. Like, you felt satisfied, like a satisfied, and I don't think you get that today in like serial in floppies that much, you know. It's not as good as it used to be. So that's a really good choice, Don. I mean, that's one of my favorite comics of all time, so good call, good moment. Paul, what's your number six?
My number six is Invisibles number 12.
Oh, that's right. Invisibles.
Yeah, Invisibles number 12. The Invisibles is a crazy, crazy series written by Grant Morrison, and it is essentially it's a superhero book set in a world where every conspiracy theory is real. Mm-hmm. In the introduction, they introduce the main character. His name's Dane. He is sort of a homeless street kid. When we meet him, he's just a punk. He's just a generally horrible person. Mm-hmm. And he's recruited into this group called the Invisibles by King Mob, who's this cold-blooded assassin who is also sort of Grant Morrison's avatar throughout this book.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's got a bunch of really cool, interesting things, but in issue 12, like, it just sort of turned everything around, because when they in the first arc where King Mob comes into this boarding school where Dane's being held captive, and he just exterminates the soldiers who are sort of keeping the kids down in the school. I mean, he just comes in and, you know, he just murders every single one of them to get him out. You know, it's impressive, because it's one of those things where, like, it's the first time you sort of see the character in action and you see what he's capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the thing that sort of cements the reality of the situation in for Dane. But on issue 12, they go through, I remember the name of it is called Best Man Fall. And it takes the perspective of one of those soldiers that was killed in the school.
Oh, wow.
And you go through the dude's whole life. You meet his girlfriend, it's just, you know, he's jobless for a while, you know, he ends up getting this job, and he becomes this extremely likable character, and he was just, you know, this guy who was killed in a panel, you know, in the previous issue. And it makes you start thinking about all of these people that are in this book, and how literally every person, you know, in this story has their own story to tell if you want it to be that way. And it also flips it around, you know, who are the good guys here, you know? Yeah. You know, these are the supposed good guys, you know, who are, you know, here to liberate mankind, yet here they are killing people and, it's the first time that the essentially ultra violence is sort of brought into question, and the violence as a means to an end is sort of studied throughout the entire book. But really, really memorable in the sense of, like, suddenly this guy who was a nothing, you know, suddenly has great significance, and, you know, and that action, the action of him killing this character carries has implications that reach further on into the book. And I mean it really opened up the world of storytelling in a big way for my head, because, you know, it's how many times do you see sort of the nameless henchman blown away or thrown off the building or something like that? It's like, well, what was their story? And yeah, this issue tells that story, and it's a really heartbreaking story too.
Wow, I really got to pick this Invisibles. You've recommended that to me throughout the years, and I know they just came out with like a giant omnibus edition. I've got to check that out, because that description of that issue alone makes me want to pick it up. I mean, that sounds like a really good series. Who writes that? Who wrote that?
That was Grant Morrison.
Grant Morrison. Oh, yes. That's right. Your favorite. I'm going to have to pick that up, because that just sounds really astounding. And it sounds like it sounds really deep, to tell you the honest truth. Like, very like a thought-provoking series.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with a guy who's a filmmaker, and, you know, I found out he was a fellow Invisibles fan, and we were chatting. And, you know, we were both... honestly, the Invisibles is one of the biggest, most ambitious works of literature in a while. In a way, it's sort of like the infinite jest of comics, you know. I mean, uh-huh. it's just insanely ambitious. It doesn't always reach it. It's unsuccessful at times, but man, it aims high, and when it does hit, it hits, you know, like a ton of bricks.
Gotcha. Well, I'm going to have to pick that up for sure. I'm going to have to pick up that omnibus when I have $100 laying around. He looks huge. So once again, going back to the lowbrow, my number six is Uncanny X-Men number 175. And I don't know if anybody remembers this one. I wrote The Return of Jean Grey? So this was like a big double size anniversary issue, I believe written by, again, Chris Claremont, and illustrated by Paul Smith, if I'm correct. And what was going on in the X-Men books, as powerful as like the Death of Phoenix and all that stuff was, which it very much was, this was kind of like Madeline Pryor had been introduced into the series. And for anyone who doesn't know who Madeline Pryor was, she was basically Cyclops' girlfriend for a while, and she looked exactly like Jean Grey. And so basically, there was a lot of weirdness sort of going around with her after she was introduced into the books. Like, what's going on? How can somebody be like, look exactly like her? And basically, this number 175 was the culmination of that mystery. Was Madeline Pryor the reincarnation of Phoenix? You know, was she Jean Grey returned? And what was so great about this issue is that it not only was it the climax of the whole storyline, or supposedly, because God knows it went on and she became like the Goblin Queen and whatever God nonsense that they introduced after that, but you know, you just didn't know, was she a clone, was she reincarnation? And in this issue is when it all plays out, or at least for up to that point. Mm-hmm. And basically what you ended up finding out was that it was very much Mastermind, one of their old villains from the Hellfire Club, who was playing with illusions, and you had Cyclops ending up having to fight the rest of the X-Men through the mansion. So again, this is sort of almost going back to that Wolverine thing where it was like a Die Hard thing where Cyclops had to face off against the rest of the X-Men to get to from one side of the mansion to another so that he could, you know, convince the X-Men that he was not Dark Phoenix, because what had happened was that Mastermind kind of turned things around and made the X-Men think that Dark Phoenix had returned and that it was Cyclops. So it was just a really good issue, and it was one of the first times I had ever seen like sort of a mystery play out in a comic where like it was like, what's going on? I don't know what's happening. This is kind of weird. And then, you know, finally the mystery gets revealed and it's like, oh, because the big expectation for me was like, oh, it is going to be Phoenix, like she's back or whatever. And then it was like, sorry, you know, it's just another villain plot, but it was just so well played out. And the other reason that I really loved it is because Cyclops has always been one of my favorite X-Men. You know, despite all the disrespect he gets, I feel like, you know, a lot of people crap on Cyclops. And in this issue, he used his mind to outsmart all the rest of the X-Men. He knew, he used his layout of the mansion, he used his knowledge of everyone else's powers to sort of figure out a way to survive the gauntlet of X-Men that were coming after him. Mm-hmm. And that really just blew my mind, because for a long time it was like, Cyclops just has eye beams and whatever. And it was that issue where I was, it kind of solidified like Cyclops at the time, and I still feel like he is like my favorite X-Man, because he takes the burden of responsibility and puts it on his shoulders, but he's also smarter and craftier than a lot of people give him credit for, because there's no way that you're going to be the leader of the X-Men and not be that way, you know. And so that was the issue that I really loved.
That was a double issue, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a double issue. It was like an anniversary issue.
Yeah,
I don't know if it was like 10 or 15 years, but and Paul Smith's artwork is just absolutely astounding in it.
The art was spot on. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you said X-Men to me, like think of an X-Men cover.
Yeah,
that's the one that springs to mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautifully illustrated. You know, the pacing of the story is well done, and it's just like as much of a, you know, incredible moment as, you know, everything that had gone before it, like this kind of culminated in like, whoa, what's happening? And then at the end, you know, you find out that Madeline Pryor, at least at the time, was not a clone, was not a reincarnation, was not in anything. She was just a normal human being. And that was kind of like refreshing, you know, that it's like, oh, there's a real person here, you know, that is going to join the X-Men family. And, you know, and then they get married later on and the nonsense ensues throughout the 90s and all that gets crapped on. But at the time, I just remember really blowing away. And it's one of my other like big X-Men memories where I was like, huh, wow, this played out really well. So that was my number 6. On to number 5. We are halfway. Corey, what is your number 5?
So this, at this point is where things are starting to get a little weird.
Okay.
So my 5 is Ed the Happy Clown by Chester Brown.
Oh, okay. Ed the Happy Clown. Never heard of it.
This is sort of, I guess it would be classified as an underground comic, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
Certainly alternative.
Uh-huh.
Definitely indie. And in this was originally released in the 80s. And he had his own sort of self-published little anthology, self-anthology title called Yummy Fur.
Uh-huh.
And then one of the recurring stories was Ed the Happy Clown, and Drawn and Quarterly recently collected everything and put it out as a book. And it had previously, after college, I moved obviously to Los Angeles, where I am now, and met somebody at work, different person who I've lost touch with entirely, but he lent me his copy of a previous collection of Ed the Happy Clown.
Uh-huh.
And it it definitely blew my mind. It is surreal. It's absurd. It's weird. It's just generally messed up. But it's funny. But the characters are sincere, and the plotting is so ingenious. He initially was writing it basically improvisationally. He was just sort of, he would write little short snippets that seemed completely unrelated. Uh-huh. And then he started to tie them together, and he was able to bring all these really random, weird characters and bring them into the same world and tie all the plot points together. And it's really, it's bizarre, but how he ties everything together is just ingenious.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's you know, it's scatological. There's nudity. There's Ronald Reagan is the head of somebody's penis. I mean, it's really weird.
Uh-huh.
But it's just delightfully bizarre, weird, dark, and so fascinating. Uh-huh. So I just love it. So and it's probably the most clever comedy writing I've ever written.
Oh, cool.
I've ever read. Most clever comedy writing I've ever read.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So it's hard to describe, but this kind of the story is Ed the Happy Clown is this sort of childlike clown character who just has horrible things continually happening to him, but he somehow maintains this, you know, this wide-eyed innocence. And and then there's this other guy who can't, you know, to put it, I don't know what our rating is on the show, but he can't stop pooping. You know,
gotcha.
That's all I'll say. And so somehow he is connected to another dimension, uh-huh. And that's his that's the gateway. So in this other dimension, Ronald Reagan, who looks nothing like Ronald Reagan, they discover this, and so Ronald Reagan falls into the dimensional portal. At the same time, Ed the Happy Clown apparently accidentally gets his penis stuck inside this guy's butt, and then Ronald Reagan gets his penis, but you don't really see it. It's sort of inferred. You sort of feel like, oh well, that must have been how it got there. And so he now has Ronald Reagan on his penis for the rest of the comic, or most of the comic. And then meanwhile, there's this other character who has a girlfriend he's sort of having an affair with, but he feels so guilty about it. And suddenly his hand, like his hand, becomes like dead, like it's like just like rubbery, like he can't use it at all.
Uh-huh.
And he assumes that this is some sort of biblical punishment, and that the only way to solve it is to kill his girlfriend while they're having sex. This is his solution.
Whoa.
And so he does this, and she somehow doesn't die. She becomes like this, you know, undead sort of thing, and then it turns out she's actually a vampire. And I mean, it's just crazy. It's just like absolute weird lunacy. But the way that he weaves everything in and out, and has the characters like interact and bounce off each other, it's so fascinating and weird and bizarre. It was unlike anything I'd ever read, and it really opened up my mind to that. I mean, comics can really be whatever and be as weird as they want. I mean, like,
yeah.
Apparently this has been optioned as a movie.
How?
I don't know how it could ever be a movie.
Because just your description to me, I'm like, what is this? I don't...
The Wikipedia on this is one of the funniest things I've ever read.
Really?
It talks about Ronald Reagan. It says, originally Brown had intended to use Ed Broadbent, a left-wing politician and leader of the Canadian New Democratic Party. But he changed it to Reagan because Broadbent was so obscure. He would have just been a name. He later regretted the decision, saying he could have included an explanation in the back of the book as to who Broadbent was. They were not intended to have political statements. He wasn't very political aware at the time, had only the vaguest notions of what politics are. Although he said he would have believed in the NDP's policies at the time. Later, he became a libertarian, and while Reagan was no libertarian, Brown later believed that Reagan was the best president of the U.S. since Calvin Coolidge.
Sounds crazy.
Yeah,
that's so funny because
he's a weird guy. But
I definitely have a comic series, and it's not in my top 10. That is very much like that, where it's like bizarre and crazy. Which is like Milk and Cheese, which I consider one of the best comic series ever.
Oh yeah,
created by Evan Dorkin. I don't think it's quite as bizarre as what you're talking about, Corey, but it is definitely one of my top comic series of all time. So that's great. I'm gonna have to check this out. I mean, is it worth picking up, or is it just something that you came across like and were like, this blew my mind, and I don't know if I can recommend it to other people? But
no, I recently reread it actually, and it helped. I mean, it was still just as delightfully bizarre. I mean, it's just, it's just just go in expecting craziness, just absolute lunacy. But he somehow justifies everything. Like, everything makes sense. And in a way, I think one of the reasons why I appreciate it so much is, in a way, it kind of reminds me of, like, I do improvisational comedy on the side.
Yeah.
And a lot of weird stuff can come out because you're just making stuff up. Just on the spot, you're just it's just whatever's coming into your head, and so stuff can get really bizarre. But everything has to be justified, and everybody has to agree on it and accept it as real. And that's exactly what he does. Like, when he started this, he was basically just improvising. Like, it wasn't really meant to be an ongoing story. It was just like a one off. And then he did another one off, and then he did something that was completely unrelated. And then he decided that they were in the same world, and so he just kept going. So
that's cool.
I just find it incredibly imaginative and creative, despite being absolutely, I guess subversive and deviant in a lot of the topics it covers.
Oh, that's awesome. Cool. So, Don, what's your number five? Is it crazy as Corey's?
I don't think, I don't go after Corey anymore. The order here.
We can reverse the order.
No, mine is weird. But not nearly as weird, so it actually helps me out. Well, my number five is Stan Sakai's Usagi Yojimbo. The story Grass Cutter, which was volume 12 of Usagi Yojimbo, was the Eisner Award-winning epic that he created with his anthropomorphic, his Ronin Rabbit. You know, and a lot of people get weirded out because you have this this Ronin, this samurai, 17th century feudal Japan, and a bunch of animals walking around with swords. But Sakai storytelling is so good. What I tell people, and you can try it out yourself if you've not yet read Usagi Yojimbo, is start to read the stories, and it takes a lot of people out that there's a rabbit walking around as a samurai. But you, after reading it for a while, you can't even tell that they're animals. You take the storyline is serious. They're, in particular, Grass Cutter is, looking for the sword of the gods. Basically, he's trying to recover that. So he's weaving real events, mythological events, and then putting them, retelling them in his own unique way with Usagi.
Huh. I've never read Usagi Yojimbo. I don't know why, because it looks like something that I would probably love, but I've just never read it. I mean, it's more of a serious, because it looks like it would be like a funny animal book or something, but the storylines are serious?
They're dramatic, yes. There's some comedy in there. He's got, there's one of his friends, Jen, who's a rhino. I mean, he's a little bit, he's kind of a funny character. But after a while, he's a very serious samurai. It's based on the life and times of a real, Miyamoto Musashi, and it is 17th century feudal Japan, and he's going over several events that are historical based, and some of them obviously, but a lot of Japanese mythos is included in there. So you have some incredible elements. You have some fantastical, bits with creatures that walk in and out of being undead, and that. So mythology, history, a little bit of fantasy, but it's all kind of rolled into one. But yeah, Usagi himself is a very, very serious character. And after a while, like I said, after two or three books of reading it, I don't even really look at him as as a rabbit, he's a badass, and he really is. Usagi is, you don't want to mess with the guy. You know, two or three bad guys, get him trapped in a room with this. He's gonna take you apart.
That's cool. I'm gonna have to check that book out because, I love samurai. Well, I love like manga, Japanese stuff, and stuff like that. And I mean, this definitely seems like I saw he had an exhibit here in Little Tokyo. In downtown, and the artwork was just fantastic. I just went down there to check the artwork out, and his art is absolutely beautiful. So I'm definitely going to have to check that book out. Cool. Is there any one particular moment in the series that stands out to you, Don, or just in general, the whole series is like very intense and great? And
Well, the whole series is really good. I mean, there really isn't a bad. His style kind of changes from, because he starts off. In a few comics, then he goes to Mirage Studios, then he goes to Fantagraphics, and then Dark Horse. I think by the time he gets to Dark Horse, he's refined his art style down a little bit, and it's probably when he's at the top of his craft and how he wants it to look, and kind of takes some of the earlier ones. I guess the art definitely improves by the time you get to like the sixth or the seventh trade. It's up to like 25 now, but you can just pick up one and have a good time. Grasscutter's the award-winning one. So
gotcha. I mean, it looks like he's got like how many books? It's amazing.
He's very prolific.
Yeah, and this is all he does. Like, I mean, that's pretty amazing. Is he basically has he just been basically self-publishing this book, and that's pretty much what he's been doing since the beginning, or?
Well, he started off. He was a letterer, and he had started off good pals with Stan Lee, lettering the Spider-Man strip, the newspaper strip for Spider-Man. He was a letterer.
Oh,
Stan Lee. So yeah, he kind of got in as a letterer, and then he had his own creation, Usagi, that started off again like with Radio Comics, The Adventures of Nilsson, Grand Thumper, and Hermie. That was one of his original characters. But Stan Sakai is a fantastic creator, fantastic artist. And yeah, he writes, draws, 25 trade paperbacks and counting. He had fun. He did like a spinoff, one that is a little bit more fun, Space Usagi. He did one trade, just something completely different, so he could do a science fiction book to be different. But yeah, he's I think getting ready to relaunch the series. It's been on hiatus. He did, a different story for Dark Horse over the last year, and his wife's gone through some problems. They're actually doing a fundraiser in the industry right now to help some of the medical expenses that he's going through. But Stan Sakai, super sweet human being, super awesome stories. You can just jump in on any one of the 25 trades that are out there and have a good time.
Yeah, Caps is doing a fundraiser for him right now to help, I guess his wife is ill, and to help pay for the medical bills. I've got to pick up some of these books because they look like very interesting to me. I mean, I've always really liked sort of like the anthropomorphic animals, the cartoon animals, and this has got samurai stuff, so I'm down with that. That's very cool. Paul, go ahead.
The historical Musashi was the first samurai who was known for using the two-sword style of fighting.
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, this looks like it would be a great animated show. I mean, it looks fantastic. I wonder if it's an option.
Ninja Turtles. Yeah, he's been on Ninja Turtles a few times. He's friends with
him. Yeah.
So in that same era of the Turtles. So yeah, he's shown up on that cartoon a few times. And
that's cool.
Hey, that's perfect because that's mine. That's my number five. Ninja Turtles, because
nice.
I still have a bunch of the original, sort of black and white garage published stuff, because I mean I think I got them just because it's like, well, that's crazy,
Yeah.
They're ninjas. I was familiar with ninjas, and of course I know what a turtle is, But but they're mutant ninja turtles, and not only that, they're teenagers. But I picked them up because like they were just sort of so weird looking, and they were so dark, really, thematically compared to what they turned into on the. With the kids show and everything like that, but those original sort of self-published things were really cool, dark, sort of Miller-esque, you know, it's, I think in their own way, they did quite a big, they were a big step toward the grim and gritty movement that happened too. But, you know, but at the same time, it was ridiculous because they were turtles. But there was some really, there was some good storytelling there. There was some good science fiction stuff that would go on in there. And the turtles all had fairly distinct personalities. Even, I mean, you couldn't always tell who was who physically because it was a black and white book. You know, later they came up with the color thing to differentiate them, but they all had their own personalities that were unique enough that you understood who was who beyond just what weapon are they carrying. And I think that that's something that's definitely gotten lost, you know, through the cash machine that they've turned into, is that, you know, that these were originally good conflicted characters, you know, who were trying to make their way through a universe they didn't understand. Very Howard the Duck in its own way.
Sure, sure. It's interesting because I've been picking up, it's interesting that you mentioned the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because I've been picking up those hardcover collections, the IDW ones, that pick up the very early Eastman and Laird, you know, issues, and I'm on the first one now. I bought the first three, and I've been going through them as I've had time, because the first one I picked up because I have a friend at work who's was very much into the Ninja Turtles. He bought, I guess they recently came out with this giant action figure set, which had like all four of the turtles, and they were in black and white, and it was just this really nicely done set. And he's not into comics or anything like that, but he used to love the Ninja Turtles. So when I heard that those hardcovers were coming out, I decided to pick the first one up and just be like, okay, what's this? And it's interesting how crude the artwork is, but I picked it up and I was like, okay, you know. But once I started reading it, like, I loved it. Like, I couldn't believe how much I loved it, because they're just fun. You know what I mean? They're
and
just like,
they were clearly made by guys who enjoyed this stuff. They enjoyed the ninjas. They enjoyed kung fu. Mm-hmm. They enjoyed, you know, science fiction. I mean, like, their love of all of this stuff just sort of shines through, and that's what sort of transcends sort of the crappy printing of these original books. You know, I mean, these were some of the worst printed things I think I've ever seen.
Yeah,
but like, I didn't care, you know, and in a way that crappy printing sort of made it cool too.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It was a big thing for me. Plus, they were also really hard to get a hold of in Hawaii, where I grew up. You know, you would get an issue here, and you know, then maybe you'd hear about like a store on the other side of the island that happened to have the next one. You know, so you'd have to, like, it was, you know, back to, you know, like what we were saying earlier about, you know, sort of having to track it down, you know, pre-internet and stuff like that. You know, it's the game was a big part of it.
Cool. Yeah, no, I totally understand what you mean, because the book that I'm reading now has a lot of commentary too, and commentary from Eastman and Laird, like in the end of the chapters, and I've been reading that, and you could tell that they were just like, we love this stuff, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's just like, they love Jack Kirby. Everything that they did originally was like aping a lot of like Kirby style, you know, or the Kirby method of storytelling, like big splash pages, lots of action. And, you know, as crude as the artwork is, you're absolutely right, the enthusiasm on those books just shines through. And they weren't afraid to go crazy, like you said, the sci-fi stuff. Like, within like the first four issues, they're on an alien planet, and it's like, what? Like, what happened here? You know, and with a race of rhinoceroses and little brain-looking alien. Like, it's just, it's stuff that maybe when I was taking comics too seriously, like, I was like, oh yeah, I'm not. But now that I'm looking for fun and just like escapism as an older person, like, I think it's the tops. I think it's just like really good. That's a good choice, Paul. And that's some really solid stuff. Let me see. My number four, let's see, where was I? Oh, okay. Incredible Hulk, Volume 1, number 278. The Hulk gets amnesty.
Internationally.
Yeah. I very much, it's funny because I'm pulling a lot of stuff from my adolescence. I remember seeing that cover where the Hulk is like, give me amnesty or give me death or something. And like all the superheroes are coming at him. And I just remember seeing that cover and being like, something big is happening here, like with the Hulk. And I don't think I even knew what amnesty was, but I remember buying the comic and reading it and being like, oh, they're going to pardon the Hulk. But which made my mind just like go out of the back of my head, because like that was the big thing with the Hulk, especially if you were exposed to the TV show, that he was like on the run for crimes that he didn't commit. And, you know, and you had Thunderbolt Ross, and it was just like this really big moment in comics history for me, because it was one of the first times I remembered being like, oh, this is not the status quo. They're going to mess around. They're going to do something different, you know, like really different. Like the Hulk's supposed to be misunderstood. And I think at this point, he had adapted Banner's personality, you know, so it was like Banner in control of the Hulk, which blew my mind out even further. I was like, what is happening? The Hulk is talking. Like, I don't understand. So that was like a big moment for me as a kid, like reading that comic and just being like, what? They're going to forgive? You can't forgive the Hulk. He's a rampaging monster. He's a beast, you know, and that's what they did. And that played out for a really good while. So I just remember that was one of the moments where I was like, Marvel really likes to shake up the sandbox, you know what I'm saying? So that was definitely my number five, that kind of like shook me out from reading, you know, just regular superhero adventures.
Okay, so that was part two of Part-Time Fanboys Top 10 Comic Book Moments That Blew Our Minds. Hopefully you enjoyed these picks, and please tune in again next week for part three of Part-Time Fanboys Top 10 Comic Book Moments That Blew Our Minds. Thanks for listening. Bye.